This episode is brought to you by FX's The Veil, starring Elizabeth Moss. FX's The Veil is an international spy thriller that follows two women as they play a deadly game of truth and lies on the road from Istanbul to Paris and London. One woman has a secret, and the other has a mission to reveal it before thousands of lives are lost. FX's The Veil premieres April 30th, only on Hulu.
Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hello, everybody, and welcome back to New Books in East Asian Studies, a podcast channel on the New Books Network. I am Dagena Dor, one of the hosts of the channel. Today, we're really honored to have Dr. Nicole Willock on the show to talk about her new book, Lineages of the Literary, Tibetan Buddha's Polymath of Socialist China, published by the Columbia University Press in 2021. Dr. Willock, welcome to the show.
Hi, Dagena. Thanks a lot for having me.
Thank you. Let's maybe begin our interview with self-introductions. So please say a few words about yourself and how you became interested in Tibetan studies.
There's a long story and a short story on how I got into Tibetan studies, but I'll give kind of the abbreviated version. I started studying actually Chinese pretty much right after high school, and I actually did my BA in Chinese studies at Australian National University in Canberra. And as a part of that program, they sent us to China for a year, and that was in the early 90s, and it was a really different day and age. But due to the fact that I was, you know, on a Chinese student visa at that time, I got to travel to Tibetan areas, and I was able to spend about 3 months in Lhasa at that time, and it was a life changing experience for me, and I think I approached Tibet at the beginning with this kind of young person arrogance, and that I could understand Tibetan culture through my Chinese language skills, and I quickly became humbled that was not the case, and decided that I wanted to study Tibetan, and that was. That was it. Like, I really wanted to do this. And my professor back at ANU said, well, you know, you really need to study more language to do a program in Tibetan. And I said, of course. And then I just ended up finishing my BA in Chinese studies. And then I went and to Germany, actually, to do my first MA, and I studied under David Jackson and Dorje Wangchuk, and I took classes with Jan Ohr Sobisch and others there at that time, and did MA in Chinese, but a minor in Tibetan. And it was actually Professor Jackson who recommended Indiana to me. He said, oh, I think, you know, based on your interests and stuff, you should really do your PhD in Indiana. And then it was really in Indiana that I studied Tibetan before, but it was through the, you know, incredible language program at Indiana University and under the mentorship of the late Elliot Sperling and Gendun Repsel that I devoted my complete energies to Tibetan language. And yeah, and that took me a while, but I ended up getting a PhD in Tibetan studies and then religious studies as well. I did two qualifying exams.
Wow. Well, thank you for sharing that with us. I didn't know that you started out with Chinese studies. And in the book, you also use a lot of Chinese sources. So your impressive language skills really come through in the book. So before we actually go into the book, can you tell us a little bit about how you came to write this book, Lineages of the Literary? How did you become interested specifically in these three Tibetan Buddhist polymath and their literary works?
Yeah, that's a great question. It really started after I was at Indiana University. I became increasingly interested in modern Tibetan figures who were pivotal in the 20th century, and I was studying religious studies at the time, and I felt like the dichotomous framework of how Tibetans were in China was just accurate's not quite the right word, because all of these pioneering studies, you know, really led the way for my work. But, you know, Melvin Goldstein's work, Sering Shakya's work, I'm deeply always amazed by their erudition and their scholarship. But I wanted to understand how Tibetan heroes in China were understood after the Dalai Lama left. So I was really interested in religious figures within modern China. And it was Gendun Rapsel who recommended that we start reading Seiten Shapdrung's Rungnam, or autobiography, in one of the courses. I was fortunate to have the FLAS and could study, with Rapsel in one-on-one classes at the time. And so we would, it was a very slow process at that graduate student stage of like just painfully kind of reading through the text and translating. And then I really became hooked. The more I read, the more I loved it. And then I got introduced to other scholars of that time period. But I ended up doing my dissertation work on Seiten Shapdrung's life and works, because I ended up going on the Fulbright Hayes to China and was able to just meet a lot of his former students and his disciples in the monasteries and people who were involved in, actually compiling his collected works and editing them and printing them. And so it was just a kind of a serendipitous thing that happened, and it was such an incredible experience for me. I learned so much through the scholars in China, both monastic and at the universities. And so I really focused my dissertation on Seiten Shapdrung, Jigme Rigpe Lodru. And then it was afterwards I came back and I realized how specialized, this was and how narrow. And I wanted to move on from my book, to make it more accessible to a kind of larger audience, and not just kind of be in this niche Tibetan studies world that exists. So I looked and I was reading and reread my notes, and then, it always kept popping up to me. Oh, there's, this Kepa Misum. Kepa Misum. Kepa Misum means three scholars in Tibetan. And that's how Mugi Sumten and Seiten Shapdrung and Dunkar Rinpoche were referred to. So often when I was interviewing, former students of Seiten Shapdrung, they would always, mention him parallel to these other two scholars. And then I realized, that's a way to kind of make this not just about one kind of exceptional person, but three really exceptional people. And I felt like that would draw kind of more interest in the work as well, and add something to this field and show that it's a phenomenon. And I really feel like there's many other scholars I could have looked at, but I ended up just concentrating on these three, because that would tell it's really interesting material and their lives are really interesting. So it started in grad school and then it evolved over time to become the book that it is. And also I think a huge boon in this whole process was receiving the Robert Ho Buddhist Studies Fellowship administered through the ACLS, because I was teaching a lot and after grad school and really wasn't able to come back to the material with the attention that I wanted to give to it. And without that fellowship, I know the book wouldn't be in its form the way it is. So it was quite fortunate, and I'm ever grateful for that.
Yeah, congratulations on getting that really, really prestigious funding in our field. And your book is actually really, really fascinating because, like you said, right, we're quite familiar with works on Tibetan lineages and Buddhist teachers in the pre-modern period, however you want to define that. And in the post-1949 period, there's a lot more attention devoted to Buddhist communities abroad, in exile in India, for example. But one does wonder, right, what is the situation, right, of Buddhist communities and lineages and teachers within the PRC? So your book is a huge kind of contribution highlighting that. So speaking about Buddhist teachers in the PRC, one major intervention of the book is that it complicates this binary model, right, that situates Tibetan Buddhist leaders active in the People's Republic of China, either as collaborator or resistance fighter. All right, so first, could you please tell us a little bit more about this binary model that you also mentioned in the introduction of the book? So how has the story of modern Tibet and modern Tibetan teachers in the PRC come to be commonly understood in this way?
Yeah, I think it was actually Robbie Barnett who first coined this term, this idea of a collaborator versus resistance fighter model. And it really has to do with, did Tibetans either just collaborate with the state, with the People's Republic of China, or did they resist the state? And so, in other words, that, you know, from a kind of Western lens, it seemed like that there was only these two choices for Tibetans living in China. Either they could collaborate with the state or they could resist the state. And I felt this just didn't line up. It didn't match with the materials that I was reading that were so much more complicated than this kind of binary model. And I think like the tendency in you know, telling the story of modern Tibet is then to sort of tacitly, I don't know if it's even that conscious, but it's almost like, you know, once you get into the modern period, then it needs to be a secular story. And there's lots of biographies about secular figures, Melvin Goldstein's pioneering work on Baba Phonsek Wangyal or Tashi Tsering, you know, these biographies are pioneering and very important pieces of that we have telling the story of modern Tibet. But it's almost like, you know, there's an implicit bias there because, okay, there's, you know, this founding of modern Tibet, and therefore, the Tibet in China has to be a secular story because, China is secular. And I'm making it a little bit more black and white than it is, but that's the kind of reading that I always had when I was coming up. Well, where do I place these figures who really straddle between both, you know, secular institutions and Buddhist institutions? And so how do I fit their work into, you know, the story of modern Tibet? And I realized that I needed to, kind of come up with other methods to do that.
Thank you for clarifying that. And just to linger on this topic a little bit longer, in the introduction of the book, you commented on the conundrum you faced upon taking up this project on modern Tibetan Buddhist figures active in the PRC. Specifically on here, I quote you, how exactly to study this subject matter without undue influence from polarized accounts of Sino-Tibetan historiography, unquote. So what is the methodology you adopted in this book to help you kind of move beyond these polarized historiographies?
Yeah, I think that's a really important and great question. Thank you. I really searched a lot and thought a lot about what sort of methodology I could use that would allow the voices of the scholars whose writings I was translating to really give voice to them, to allow their voices to be heard. And what I ended up turning to was not sort of standard historiographical kind of theories. I looked kind of far and wide, and what I found was that Sabah Mahmood's idea. So she's a feminist writer on actually Islamic women and the piety movement in Egypt, and I found her idea of moral agency. And how she develops this moral agency based on Foucault's work, but she takes it much further than Foucault and Judith Butler and applies it to this sort of piety movement in Egypt. But I thought about her definition and I was like, wow, this idea of finding agency not within this dichotomous framework and not emphasized on the state, not looking at agency in terms of, either collaborating with the state or resisting the state, but rather looking at agency as capacities for action. So what does that mean? What is someone's capacities for action within certain within the grammar of that situation itself. So in other words, like how do monastic scholars, so I took this idea and said, okay, how do monastic scholars then express agency? So this is their own subject formation. This is how they became scholars. So how do they use that education, that their knowledge, and how do I read that in the different situations over time that they were confronted with as individuals living in the PRC, unable to, under incredibly dire constraints sometimes, how were they still able to express their agency within these very difficult political circumstances? And once I started asking the question from that angle, everything just sort of started to flow. And I realized I could incorporate their points of view. I could still deal with the issues of the state and politics that frame their lives. Like, they wouldn't have been who they were without the political, situation as what it was. But at the same time, I don't think they were passive victims. I don't think they were really collaborators, and I don't think they were really resistance fighters. I think they used their own education, their knowledge, and they used it in very astute ways to navigate a very, very difficult terrain. Yeah.
Mm. Yeah. Speaking of expressions of agency and moral agency, for that matter, we can maybe talk about the sources you use in the book a little bit. So it's actually unexpectedly really diverse, right? So you selected a really diverse collection of texts composed by these three Tibetan Buddhist polymath in the book. They not only read these sources, not only represent a really wide range of literary styles and subject matters in traditional Tibetan literature, but they also sometimes, you mentioned, transgress traditional Tibetan literary categories in the creation of new discursive territories, specifically designed to maybe suit their needs within the restrictive environment of the PRC. So tell us more about these, really exciting sources you have used in the writings of the book. What are some of their unique features and maybe some of the challenges you had to face acquiring and studying them?
I really wanted to show that they were polymaths, like, and what that means, having mastered different types of knowledge and really showcase that. And I felt like it wasn't enough just to say that. I needed to show that and how they wrote in different ways. And really, it's such a small sample of each of these scholars' collected works. I mean, it's really incredible and humbling when you study these great scholars, because you're just like, wow. I mean, Sachin Shapcholong's, he has 13 volumes of collected works and so on. Yeah, it's just, it's incredible. But I really enjoy autobiography as a genre in English as well. So I had already translated a lot of Sachin Shapcholong's autobiography for my dissertation. So that was a natural choice to look at his autobiography. And then Muge Sumpton also, wrote an autobiography. And those autobiographies, though, they don't call them rungnam. They don't call them numtar, which is the traditional Tibetan term for you know, biography or hagiography is sometimes how it's translated. They call their works by another category, which is Zhonghua Jipa, and that is it's hard to translate really that one. I spent a lot of time you know, going back and forth on how to translate that. I think it was actually Professor Gyatso Janet Gyatso who helped me finalize it as telling what happened, a telling of what happened. And this is such an interesting choice because there are examples of you know, this Zhonghua Jipa genre prior to their writings, but they're very marginalized. They're very few. There's only three that I could find, and I list them in the book. But you know, but what's interesting is that they completely acknowledge in their writings what they're doing. So they mention, that they're not writing a numtar, they're not writing an avadana or tokchu in Tibetan. They're writing this telling what happened, this Zhonghua Jipa, and they're doing that. And because you know, they recognize that their lives are, you know, situated in this modern era, in this sort of politicized era, I think, and yet they really draw upon traditional literary frames to outline their life stories. Seitan Chapchung chooses this one of the seven characteristics or qualities of a higher rebirth to frame his entire life narrative. So it's really interesting on how they both draw upon and change these literary categories. And the same goes for essays. I mean, Dzongkha Rinpoche is really interesting because he really perfects the writing of this kind of academic essay by taking a much more kind of standard historical approach, you know, like dividing history up into different time periods and is making a chronology according to sort of periods of time that he delineates. And that's, you know, a kind of departure from other ways of writing about Buddhist history, which focus on lineages or you know, past lives, the rebirth kind of narratives that you get at the beginning of different histories and stuff. And so, it's just a really interesting to look at how these traditional literary categories change over with their writings. And so as far as like accessing and acquiring them, it's not at all difficult to get a hold of any writings pretty much these days. It's that we have so many sources available to us through interlibrary loan and the BDRC, the Buddhist resource. They just changed it. So I always used to like the Tibetan Buddhist Resource Network. Tibetan Buddhist Resource Center, rather. And you know, those sources are really easily available. I mean, I got the first version, the 1987 version of Seitan Chapchung's autobiography from the Indiana University Library. I did have to, it was difficult when in 2005, when I was there, to get the printed there. He's the only one, his collected works were the only one that I know of that was completely actually printed in the traditional way first. So in other words, his completed collected works were actually printed at the Tuwa Monastery printing house, which is a part of his monastic estates. There was a printing house that he actually founded in 1930s to print his teacher's collected works. And that printing house was rebuilt in the 1980s to both reprint his teacher's collected works and then also to start his collected works. And so I was able to get that nine volume of his collected works from the monastery, but the other two scholars, Mukhi Sumpton and Dzongkha Rinpoche's works, were both printed at the Minzu Publishing House, as well as the they were just printed at the Minzu Publishing House.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, thank you. Thank you for you know, going through these sources with us. We're going to talk about some of these newer kind of categories of writing, more of the modern kind of essay types in the university academic settings in a bit. So let's go into the book now. So chapter one introduces the three polymath in both the past and the present. Here we learn that this idea is actually a resurrected one in the post-Mao era. So who were the original historical three polymath? Sometimes I hear them referred to as the three wise men. And who are the resurrected one now featured in the book? And also, what is the significance of this category of the three wise men of the Kepa Misun?
Yeah, that's a great question. The Kepa Misun are, so there's these historical figures that honestly we don't know. They are in all of these historical texts, from the Depta Nyumpo, like the Blue Annals, or the Religious History of Dome, or Butun's Chujung, like a religious history. So this is an important point in history, because it's known as this turning point between the early diffusion of the Dharma and the later diffusion of the Dharma. So after the Tibetan Empire period, there was this sort of period of darkness, of where the Dharma didn't exist or was in retreat, at least at these certain centers. And, after the end of the Tibetan Empire period and the assassination of Lung Dharma, it's said that these original three wise men, or three polymaths, or three scholars, they're also translated as Marsh, Yakimini, Gejong, and Sangrab Sel, left central Tibet, and then they carried with them, because it was dangerous at the time to be in central Tibet, they carried with them these different Buddhist scriptures, and I think they first went to Uzbekistan, and then they went from the west all the way back to the east, and landed in Dentik Monastery. And by the time they got to Dentik, they were quite old. And then there was this young boy called Gumpa, who later became known as Lachen Gumpa Rabsel. And then Lachen Gumpa Rabsel was then responsible for ordaining these, the 10 men, who came from central Tibet seeking ordination. And among them is this very important figure, Lume, who, is considered, he went back to central Tibet and started this, is credited with starting this later diffusion of Buddhism. So the three wise men, or the three polymaths, the historical three polymaths, are kind of symbols, I guess you would say, of Buddhism surviving under, the most difficult circumstances of the reign of Lung Dharma and the aftermath of Buddhists. Now, this is Buddhist historiography and a kind of, I think an idealized version of history, because, people like Luchanio Patek and others have tried to study this period and really tried to get the dates. And of course, Heather Stoddard also has a really important piece on this. But that era of history is so fragmented, and the historical record is so unclear, that the dates and the historical veracity of this is really not known. But the people at Dentik Monastery, the monks there, and the people who come, the pilgrimage and the Lade, the kind of, community all around Dentik, they all think that, that this really happened here. Like this ordination of Gumpa Rabsel was done by the three polymaths, the original three a historical polymath, Mario and Sung, and that's happened at this place, at this site in Dentik. And there's this cave that still, is said to be the place where this ordination took place. So, and then you had asked also about the, how that title of the three polymaths then became resurrected in the post-Mao era. This is really important. So that symbolism of the title, the three polymaths, became a kind of reference point for so many modern day scholars. So they looked back to that period of, you know, this kind of era of darkness after the reign of Long Dharma, and they realized, you know, that they had just went through a similar period where Buddhism had been oppressed and repressed, and they looked to the three polymaths, so Muge, Sumten, Seichen, Chapdong, Dzongkhar Los, and Chunlei, and they realized that you know, they're the ones who sort of carried the torch across, you know, this really horrible 20-year period, and they were resurrecting the Dharma in this new age, this new Yungdar era is what the sort of post Mao era is often referred to, according to Tibetan scholars. And that's significant because that frames time, you know, the very essence of our reality is time, right? That frames time according to a Buddhist worldview, not according to, you know, the political leaders like Mao or Deng, or the economic reforms that were initiated in the post, you know, in the 1980s under Deng's rule. So, you know, this is a really significant title, The Three Polymaths, because it shows, again, agency. It shows how, you know, Tibetans have certain values and they're going to write and state those values and try to uphold those values in, you know, even in the most difficult circumstances. So The Three Polymaths then becomes a really important modern symbol for the, you know, the ongoing you know, how do you say, like the it's testimony to their legacy and how they really, you know, are able to transmit this Tibetan Buddhist knowledge and practices and institutions, you know, even, you know, to the next generation, especially that's really the key to the next generation in the aftermath of the horrors of the Cultural Revolution. And prior to that, you know, the Great Leap Forward and so on. So, yeah.
Yeah, thank you. It's really fascinating, this you know, temporality, right? That it's there in this idea of the three polymaths is remembered by the students of these three Buddhist teachers. And about the three polymaths themselves and how they remembered history and the world that they were a part of. This is something that's sort of addressed in chapter 2, where you looked at their autobiographies. So two of the polymaths, Muge Sumten and Tetun Shabdrung wrote autobiographies. A third polymath, Dzongkhar Losen Chunlei, actually did not, you mentioned in this chapter. And their autobiographies were in actually quite recent, I guess, right, or relates in 1993 and 1978, respectively. So how do these autobiographies remember, you know, their lives, right, and the parts of the kind of lineages that they were a part of, time, like you mentioned, Tibet, Sino-Tibet relations, and also maybe the rest of the world, right, you know, at this kind of important turning point, the switching into the Yungdar era after Mao and the PRC came into power. So you mentioned in this chapter that some things are included while certain things weren't. So can you tell us a bit more about that?
Yeah, definitely. I think, you know, the interesting thing about the 1950s and how both Muge Sumten and Seichen Chapdrung frame their memories of the 1950s is through this idea of spiritual friendship, of having, of remembering the Sangha, the kind of monastic community, and having other monks who were respected and had these similar ideals, and how these were really very well respected at that time period. And it's really jarring in some ways to read this because Seichen Chapdrung especially remembers like meeting his fellow throne holder. So Seichen Chapdrung is he's an incarnate lama, and he shared the throne of six monasteries. One of them was Dantik, and he had his own monastery called Tuck Monastery as well. So he shared them with his fellow throne holder called Seiten Kempo. And Seiten Kempo was killed. He was murdered in 1958. And, you know, I only found that out from my field work there. That is not in any of the texts. It's only kind of alluded to in one other text by Seitan Chapchong, which is a history of Dentik Monastery called Dentik Karchuk. And in that, it lists the different Seitan Chapchong and Seitan Kempo incarnations and gives brief histories on that, and also like history of the monastery and how it was founded, and how each of the sort of satellite temples were founded and their histories. It mentions in that text in the Dentik Karchuk that Seitan Kempo died in 1958, but it doesn't say how. And Seitan Chapchong's autobiography also doesn't mention it, but he does go into this, you know, kind of elaborate meeting with Seitan Kempo, and this, you could just feel like this kind of sense of their friendship, because they had been through some hard times. Like as young children, they actually fought, like physically got into this fist fight on the playground, and they had to be kind of torn apart by their respective kind of mentors and stuff. And yet they reconciled and became, you know, friends. And here they are, you know, how old were they? They're like in their 40s, right? So they were born in the 30s. They're in their 30s because they're born in the same year. And, you know, so they're in their prime in so many ways, but they see what's happening before them. And, you know, there's no mention of land reform, like that the words land reform are not being used, but the dates that are given are all in Tibetan dates, Tibetan calendars. So you have to kind of a lot of comparing and contrasting, and with comparative tables that Dieter Schu did, in order to resurrect the actual dates that where these events must have taken place, and then compared them with the Chinese sources that I know. Like there's these local gazetteers called the Difengzhi, and they have very detailed political events in them. Like, so, you know, 1954 is land reform in this county in Jinyuan, and you know, 1958, you know, this monastery was turned into a commune, and so on. So it was through like comparing, the autobiographical information and these, you know, incredibly beautiful stories about, you know, this friendship and talking about the Dharma and, you know, and giving these teachings, and then comparing that and contrasting that with what actually happened on the ground. And then, you know, in Muge Sumtin's autobiography, he actually gives a long account of meeting Seitan Chapchong in Beijing when they're translating Mao Zedong's collected works into Tibetan. And they're on this translation committee together, and they share a room in Beijing together. And, you know, they talk about, you know, he talks about going to Xiangshan in, to the west of Beijing and visiting the Fragrant Hills and how beautiful it was, and going to, these different temples and seeing the Buddha's relics and so on. And so, you know, he also remembers this time period through this kind of lens of mutual respect and mutual understanding. And when you think about that, right, it's so important in the 1980s, because so many monks had to give up their vows. Muge Sumtin and Seitan Chapchong themselves did not give up their vows, but they were forced to wear lay clothes. But they did maintain celibacy throughout their lives, and they were very that was very important to them. So in their remembering of the 1950s, they go back and they look at this time period as one where Buddhist values were respected, where they were able to meet His Holiness, the Dalai Lama, and the Panchen Lama. They remember when, you know, Mao Zedong and Zhou Enlai respected, these Buddhist lamas, and so it's this kind of sense of respect and importance they had in the state that's crucial from a Buddhist perspective.
Yeah, so really interestingly, this chapter also brings to our attention the 14th Dalai Lama or current Dalai Lama's piece of work, Munlan to Mao, which is kind of like a tribute to Mao, which is dated to 1954. And you compare this piece of literary artifact to the autobiographies of Mugye Samtan and Thitin Shabdrung. Can you tell us a little bit about this? And do they remember this period in the 1950s in a similar way?
Yeah, I think they do. One is that, you know, we see this kind of poetry, praise poetry being used. And that's a really, I think, important thing is that, you know, this idea of poetics and the use of poetics to frame how people express their emotions. Like, I think for monks, you know, there's a certain thing where you're not supposed to express your emotions. There's not a lot of ways to get that out. And what you see is that that poetry and especially plays a role in that. And, you know, we'll talk more about that in the when we talk about chapter three as well. But I think for what's important, I mean, Munlam to Mao is a different genre of text. Like I don't consider it the same genre as the autobiographies at all, in the sense that it is like it kind of follows a whole. There's a lot of different examples in Tibetan history of you know, rulers or the Dalai Lama, you know, praising a ruler of China. That's not really I guess so new. But what I think is so interesting about this and what they have in common is this idea that. That there's a respect for the Dharma, that Mao, that it's anticipated that the state will protect Buddhism, that is, you know, like there's this, you know, one image of Mao as like a kind of Garuda, you know, like this kind of protector of Buddhist teachings. And there's that hope that, you know, that the state and that Mao himself will be a protector, like, you know, like in the Qing dynasty, like they were, you know, that like previous rulers, you know, of China. And of course, you know, that's not the case, you know, but I think there's that hope, and that to me is also expressed in Mugye Samtan and Sechen Shabdrung's works, but it's for a different reason. It's for the reason that in the 1980s, you know, that they're trying to revive these traditions, and they go back and say, hey, look, you know, there was a point in time where, you know, Buddhism was very well respected, and yeah, look at this, you know, remember this time period.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's really fascinating. And speaking of poetry, chapter three really dedicates to the poetic writings by these three Buddhist polymaths, specifically about the two decades from the late 1950s to the late 1970s. So this decade also witnessed the Great Leap Forward and the Cultural Revolution, of course, which created famine, chaos, and violence in the Tibetan regions. So here you remind us that these poetries written by the three Buddhist polymaths actually do not offer true-to-life exposés of what happened to them during this period. So tell us how you approach these poetic writings and what they have revealed for us instead.
The poetry, I mean, first of all, translating poetry is really difficult. It's really, really hard, but it's so worth it. And at the beginning, when I was, you know, translating Sechen Shabdrung's autobiography, where some of the poems are from, you know, I would skip over the verse. You know, I just would skip over it because it was just so overwhelming as a graduate student. I couldn't handle it. Like, I was like, okay, this is just too much. I'm going to just stop and like, I'm going to skip over this section and I'll come back to it later. And eventually I did go back to it after I, you know, studied more of poetics. Like I then, you know, went and studied Sechen Shabdrung's kind of primer, the Nyanak Chidun, which is basically an introduction to how to use poetics. And once I really studied how poetry works, I realized that there's certain formulas to it and how creative, how poetry allowed for this kind of creative use of their of expression of emotion that other genres just don't allow. And it's really like, you know, through these, you know, some of these poems that you really get the sense of what happened, you know, during that time period. And it's nothing explicit, like I said, like you summarized. It's just, it's through references, for example, of Satan Chapter 2, Lung Dharma, and how, you know, Lung Dharma himself, the sort of, let's use the traditional Tibetan Buddhist historiography here of like, you know, the evil, you know, anti-Buddhist king Lung Dharma could not have even dreamt of the things that were happening at that time period, you know? And so again, you get these references to past Tibetan history, but how they apply in the present and how they felt about this time period, you know, comes through these poetic works in different ways. And so I really try to highlight how, you know, by paying attention to what poetry gives to us, you know, as readers, like we have to understand poetry more. I feel like in Tibetan studies, there's a there's still a lot of bias against poetry, like the similar to the ones that I myself had. Like, one, it's hard. Two, it's just like it's kind of wordy sometimes, and it's difficult to get through. But once you understand that there are, you know, that there's certain frameworks that if you can just, you know, kind of get beyond that first initial hesitation, that it's so worth reading because it gives a whole other aspect to, you know, their lives and understandings of the world that really are not offered elsewhere in the prose section. So yeah, that's why I ended up really spending so much time on the poetry. And for Muge Sumpton, you know, he creates these gur, you know, and gur are these it's a kind of more a folk style type of poetry, not as ornate as the Nyenak or the Kavya inspired style. But, you know, he talks about experiencing, you know, a certain insight into the state of reality of being impermanent, of this life, the impermanence of this life that we have, and this kind of insight from this Buddhist perspective on that impermanence when he's being struggled against in this, you know, in this, you know, kind of torture, public humiliation session. And he's joyous. He says he's joyous. And he kind of exclaims like in this sort of joy of this. And you know, I read this and I was kind of horrified. Like at first, I was like, "How can we experience joy in this?" But it's only because you have to really read it in the context of like he's talking about this, having this kind of spiritual realization, and he uses poetry to express that. And that's another reason why I think the poetry is so important, is because it gives voice to these kind of insights into a kind of spiritual insight that prose, you know, also does not allow.
Yeah, thank you. Yeah, you definitely showed really, really well in this chapter that, you know, there's affective work, you know, that can be found, right, in this particular genre that it's not available for us to look at elsewhere. Chapter 4 now turns our attention to a really fascinating figure, one of the three polymaths, Dungar Rinpoche, who is both a Marxist theorist and a Gelug Buddhist scholar. So here you discuss how he redefined Tibetan identity within the parameters of the CCP state discourse of ethnic minorities, as well as how he reinvented the idea of religion in Tibetan language discourses. So based on this work, how did he narrate the history of Tibet and its religions, and how did he understand also Sino-Tibetan relations?
Yeah, Dungar Rinpoche's work on the merging of the religious and the secular in Tibet is probably one of the few works that was translated into English. And I think it was, I'm trying to think of when it was translated into the English. I think it was the late 80s. But he wrote it a decade before. This was the first, his history, Chuse Tsungchel, was the first Tibetan language history about Tibet written in China, as far as I know. Like that I haven't seen a kind of history of Tibet in Tibetan prior to this work. And so this is an incredibly important contribution. And he does it, he does it in the frame, he writes it in the framework of the sort of Marxist, Chinese Marxist teleology of, like, you know, of different class periods. And he frames Tibetan history within that. On one hand, like, and you know, we have to draw attention to that, because that is the, you know, basically he takes these different eras of Tibetan history and says this is the, you know, this is this feudal era and so on. So that's there. But within that framework, the richness of detail has been so overlooked by so many, I think, historians. It's just, it's so important, this work, because you know, he gives reign titles and he gives detailed, you know, analysis of the inconsistencies sometimes in dating time periods. And so his take on history is much, much more than just simply a Marxist take on history. And he's the one scholar who often was simply flat out called a collaborator with the Chinese, but I always felt that was a bit unfair to him. And since then, honestly, he has really been resurrected. Like in Dharamsala, like 2 years ago, there was a big symposium on his I think it was the 20th anniversary of his death. So it must've been in 2017 already now. So several years ago, 5 years ago. That event really showed what an incredible scholar Dzongkhar Rinpoche is, and his works are becoming more well read now. I was just reading Jose Cabazon's book on Sera Monastery, and he actually looks at some of Dzongkhar Rinpoche's histories of Sera in that work. And so, but what I found very fascinating about when I went back to read this text is how, one, he finds room within this Minzu discourse, you know, on this sort of state ethnic minorities, to make room for Tibetan history, and that is, you know, it's really inventive. Like it's one of those you know, moves where he looks at, you know, where is it, you know, in this you know, the framing of the state, you know, how the state works, and where can we plug in Tibet? And he uses that discourse of Minzu, you know, of nationality identity or ethnic minority identity to really, you know, highlight and showcase Tibetan history. And also he brings all the, you know, he brings all of these different religious traditions, like, or schools are, you know, like the Sakya, the Kagyu, the Bun, and so on. And he calls them all Chuluk. And Chuluk, you know, is of course like, you know, the system of Chu, and Chu is, you know, Dharma. But that term is just sort of a translation, the Tibetan translation of the Chinese term Zongjiao. So he is, but prior to that, like in the Tibetan histories that he looks at, like rarely is Chuluk used as a term. Like historically, it's not used as a term for all religions, right? It's used as a term for a specific Dharma way by a specific school, or, you know, and so he's renegotiates this term that's in Tibetan discourse, but then he uses it in such a way as to give a kind of a common space for all of these different Tibetan traditions, not just Gelug from where he comes, but also Bun. He really highlights the importance of Bun history in his work. And so it's in this way that he cleverly uses like the kind of means available to him to, you know, write this, you know, pioneering history in Tibetan language. And that's, that gets read by, you know, the next generation of scholars and becomes such a, you know, a pivotal piece, for understanding, Tibetan history, and within that Sino-Tibetan history, right? But he's no fool. Like I think Dzongkhar Rinpoche, you know, he had to sort of toe the party line in some ways and recognize, like, you know, that in the Yuan dynasty is usually when Tibet At that time period, like when Dzongkha Rinpoche was writing, you know, Tibet became part of China during the Yuan dynasty. And that was a sort of party line at that point in time. And since then, under Xi, it's really changed a lot. And now it's kind of, Tibet has always been a part of China forever. There's no date on that. And, you know, this kind of apocryphal, you know, framing of history is what the Xi Jinping kind of, you know, the CCP does best. Like, you know, it ignores the historical facts that have happened over the time and kind of creates this other timeline of Tibet as a part of China. And Dzongkha Rinpoche really pushes back against that. Like you can see in how he would never accept like this idea that, you know, Tibet became part of China before the Mongol era. Like even within his treatment of the Mongol era, like on one hand, he says it on paper that Tibet became part of China, you know, at this time. But like the way he frames Tibet and the way he frames the Mongolian titles, it's so different than the English translation of how we read this. So it's much more nuanced. And so I hope that's what I contribute to this. This is a much more nuanced reading of Dzongkha Rinpoche's works and how he really uses Tibetan framings to think of the idea and the concept of religion within the PRC and how that really changed with his interventions.
Yeah, it is. You're definitely doing that in this chapter. And so it seems that Dzongkha Rinpoche is creating a kind of historiography and creating a certain kind of historical narrative that's it's also its own kind of lineage, which is explored in chapter 5 here. The chapter 5 is entitled Diverging Lineages. And here you investigate how these three Gelug Buddhist polymaths navigated both the Tukul system, right, this lineage of reincarnate lamas, and also the academic institution in the post-Mao era that they were also, you know, a part of. So here you point out that although their attempts to revive the Tukul tradition had failed, other more secular and academic endeavors were more successful. So tell us more about these two diverging lineages.
Yeah, this this chapter, you know, sort of steers a little bit away from the focus on the literary per se, but then talks and really brings to fore this how these lineages are so important till this day and how I don't know, I think, you know, really fought over in so many ways. So the Tukul institution was not revived until officially, at least, like allowed to be revived in China until 1991. That's when the state directive came. And of course, you know, by that time, both the Panchen Lama had passed away and Seichen Shapdrung had passed away. And they were spearheading the revival of the Tukul institution, but changing the kind of the requirements of what it means to be a Tukul by recognizing children when they're older. And that's one of the really interesting things that you see is that they said, you know, that kids should really show, you know, be older when they're recognized in order to see if their temperament is suited for this, which I found really fascinating. Just because like I'm a mom too. And I often think like how it's so young to get your kid like away from their parents at, you know, 5 or 6. Like I always found that like a kind of horrifying thing about the Tukul institution is that, you know, that often, you know, not all the time, like sometimes the parents would still stay near the monastery and stuff, but, you know, and I felt like, you know, Seichen Shapdrung recognizing that, you know, like it'd be good to recognize Tukuls that are a little bit older. And so they've had that, you know, the formative parent, you know, period with their parents and upbringing. It was really, you know, kind of innovative and yet that never went anywhere, right? That whole idea, I've never, you know, really heard that anywhere else. Like it just seems like that idea, I don't know of it being pursued in any way. Maybe there is someplace, but I don't know of it. And then you know, they also just never got the institution, the state recognition of the institution that they had hoped for during, at least during Sechen Chapchong and the Panchen Lama's lifetime. Muge Sumpton and Dzongkha Rinpoche were still alive in 1991, and you know, both lived to see the Tukku institution reinstated. And, you know, and it was at that time, shortly after that time, that Dzongkha Rinpoche himself was able to return and give Buddhist teachings at his monastery, where he was recognized as a reincarnated Lama. And, you know, there's been a sort of conflicting reports about whether there's been another Dzongkha Rinpoche recognized or not. But from what I understand is that he wished not to be recognized again, so that his incarnation lineage has died out. And then the Sechen Chapchong and Sechen Kempo lineage, so the throne holder of both the Sechen seats, has been revived. But the Sechen Chapchong has stepped down from his role kind of as an incarnate Lama, but Sechen Kempo is still quite active. So that's one side of how these kind of institutions carry on, and how they're how their contributions sort of continue, but in a kind of disjuncted way. But whereas like that whole the control over the religion has become so strong from the state, that I think that's what's causing this sort of stuntedness really in the Tukku institution in China, because there's so much state pressure on Tukkus in China. Whereas the secular and the academic endeavors of all three lamas were incredibly successful. I mean, they trained the next generation of scholars who are all leading figures in the field. And, you know, Chen Shengying is one of the most eminent historians in China. And he, you know, he was Dzongkha Rinpoche's student. Muge Sumpton's projects in Sichuan province are still ongoing. There's regular, I guess you'd call mini conferences or praising his contributions. And he really spearheaded these kind of small academic institutions, like at these schools in Sichuan province that are still, as far as I understand, active to this day. And then Sechen Chapchong trained people like Pu Wencheng, who is also like one of the great historians in China and writes a lot in Chinese on Tibetan history. And then there's Dawa Lodru, who is the head of Drungchar, which is a literary magazine, magazine is so important because it really gave the framework for modern Tibetan literature and secular literature, where Tonchuk Gyal, who's the kind of forefather the father of modern Tibetan literature, and you know, he was Dzongkha Rinpoche's student. So there's this kind of connection between their efforts in both religious fields and in secular fields that they cross over. You know, that they go in between, they weave in between these two. And make it possible, for the further study of Tibet in China.
Yeah, thank you. And at the end of the book, and also the end of this chapter of diverging lineages, you remind us that the other lineage, the more academic one, is perhaps also facing a lot more kind of suppression nowadays. You remind us that, quotes, the boundary breaching acts between the religious and secular through diverse writings and educational efforts seem to have ended with the death of this generation of polymathic scholars as the PRC tightens its control over religion, unquote. So you also point out that it's perhaps no longer possible for an incarnate Lama or Geshe to also serve as a university professor in the PRC today, as our three polymaths once did. So what is the state of the current generation of Tibetan scholars in Tibet today?
I think that's a great question. And I don't know. I don't feel as qualified to say much because I haven't been back to China in a few years. But the current generation is still wanting, I think, to learn Tibetan and, you know, really teach in Tibetan and have a thriving Tibetan studies field. I think that's the wish of many, many scholars, but I do think that the political situation is such that, you know, that it's becoming more difficult. But at the same time, you know, that still the most Tibetan texts that we have are still coming out of the PRC. So I'm hopeful that, you know, Tibetan studies will continue to thrive in the PRC. But, you know, the current policies do make me concerned. I have heard of things such as the Tibetan studies programs being closed down and things like that. But again, I'm not an expert in that. So I'd you know, defer to others who do, you know, who do get back to China and are working on the ground there today.
Yeah, thank you. That's something that we can look forward to in other scholars' work, definitely. So Dr. Willock, I think we've taken up enough of your time already. Thank you so much for, you know, sharing your wonderful work in this book. But before we close our interview, we have one final question for you. Tell us something that you're working on right now so we can anticipate more amazing work from you. And also, what is one recent book that you would recommend to our listeners?
Oh, yeah. Thank you. Yeah, I'm working on this Tibet Reader Project that is going to it's going to be a game changer. I'm working with a team of editors with Carol McGranahan, Lama Jup, Dejin Pemba, and Dunjup Tashi, Rachel Dunjup Tashi, to put together a bunch of different sources, some never translated before, some previously translated works on modern Tibet. And so it's going to be coming out with Duke University Press in a couple of years, but it's or maybe next year, but it was probably 2 years. But it's, yeah, it's a really exciting project that will come out soon. And then I'm also working on the poetry still, and I'm working on an article with Nancy Lin on poetic aesthetics and in Yung Chen Ma, and even going into Longchenpa and Tsongkhapa and the fifth Dalai Lama. So I'm looking forward to finishing that up in the next month or two. So.
Wow, exciting. Thank you for sharing that with us. I'm really, really looking forward to that reader specifically. So it will be a wonderful resource to teach, especially.
Yeah. And then as far as books, Jose Cabezon's Sarah Monastery is amazing. I'm really, really enjoying that. And Dominique Townsend's new book, A Buddhist Sensibility, also fantastic. So there's lots and lots of works in Tibetan studies right now that are coming out, and there's not enough hours in the day to read them.
Yeah, thank you so much for these wonderful recommendations. Definitely. So our listeners also feel free to go out and pick up a copy of Lineages of the Literary. I'm sure you'd love it. So thank you so much, Dr. Will, again, for devoting your time and energy to share with us your wonderful book in this interview. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Dagena.